content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Annika Gall from the NC Radio Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from, well, Thrivent Magazine and the AARP, actually, and maybe something else if we can fit it in. Well, welcome back to the new year, everyone. I'm so happy to be back with you, and I hope you had a good New Year's celebration and that it is off to a happy one for you. And I think we're going to start off today, since it is only the 8th of January, with an article from Thrivent entitled Looking Back. Members Dawn and Florence Ahrens reflect on their financial journey and the principles that guided them. Dawn and Florence Ahrens' commitment to being wise with money and living generously impressed their Thrivent financial professional, Ray Weiss. So Thrivent magazine talked with the Brenham, Texas couple on how they navigated their finances over the years, especially as they planned for retirement. Married nearly 60 years, Dawn and Florence have been retired since 2005. Both worked full-time, they raised two children, and they have three grandkids and one great-grandchild. What have been your guiding principles around money decisions? Florence, it's always been based on our values and priorities. Our main priority is God, and second is each other and our family. We knew what our needs and wants were, and we lived within our means. It wasn't always easy, but we also didn't feel we needed as many things as people do today. We made do with what we had, and we still do. How did you prepare for retirement? Dawn was vice president of a mutual insurance company. Florence was an accountant. Dawn, we had 401ks. Each year, they'd, or my employer, ask how much I'd like to contribute. If they told me 5% was the high, I'd do it. If they said 7%, I'd do it. My thought was that I will do without now, so I can retire in comfort later. And we made good investments. How did you balance saving for retirement and making memories with your children when they were young? Dawn, we took weekend automobile trips. We'd go down to the Gulf of Mexico, or there were a number of caves in Texas we'd visit. We'd pack some sandwiches and get in the car, sometimes with friends. We'd stop at a roadside park and sometimes a hotel at night. When it comes to letting your values and priorities guide your finances, did the two of you have disagreements? Dawn, we've been married for almost 60 years. We've had lots of disagreements. We always tried to sit down and talk about them and come to an agreement. Oftentimes, one gave in one time and the other gave in the next time. We still disagree, but they all get solved. Was it hard to go from a mindset of saving to spending when you retired? Dawn, it probably was, but we also had planned for it. We recently took a trip with friends from church to the Grand Canyon. This was our 40th trip together. We've traveled to Italy, Germany, and all but one state in the United States. We're actually doing today what we saved for. What advice would you give to someone facing tough money decisions? Florence, you have to set your priorities. Dawn, it's easy for us to say, but don't spend beyond your means. Even though you may love to have a high-valued auto, you may have to drive a cheaper vehicle because payments are going to be less. There will come a time, if you save and save correctly, you'll be able to enjoy those things. How have health issues over the years affected your money decisions? Florence, our wants have changed. Cancer makes you realize and appreciate what you do have. Things that are important are just not as important when facing a life and death situation. How can you give have you given back to your community? Don. For more than 50 years, I auctioneered for different organizations, hospitals, galas, fire departments, heritage societies, and school art shows. This past March was my last one. I always wanted to raise as much money as I could for organizations. I also was involved with the Washington County Fair, the local hospital foundation board, the Texas Association of Fairs and Events, Goodfellows, the JCs, and the Washington County Chamber. Florence, I'm a member of the Fortnightly Club. We collect books for an annual used book sale of 75,000 books. I've served as host for Helping One Child to Succeed, and we've both served in many roles at our church, St. Paul's Lutheran. What fuels your passion to give back? Florence, when you have wonderful things happen to you, you want to give back. All right, our next story is from the AARP magazine. It's entitled Tom Hanks on the Power of Friendship. Well, with our brand new year, let's do a brand new, not a brand new start, but how did Tom Hanks get his start? In 1978, when I was completing my second season with the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival in Cleveland, with all of two leading roles on my yet-to-be-created resume, I was in the company of peers who had been assembled from theaters all across America and talent grown right there in Cleveland. I had gone from being an unpaid actor of the intern program to a place in the professional company. Being in an ensemble of actors, the actors are come hither, my lord, is to breathe rarefied air, to be in a family of artists that, at times, can be dysfunctional to the point of warring factions. Sure, we had some creative fireworks, but 6 shows to mount and 8 performances a week from July to Thanksgiving had us laughing more than fuming. Much of that laughter came from 2 members of the professional company, George McGuire and Michael John McGann. With a freshly printed Actors' Equity Union card in my thin wallet, I had a Rubicon to cross. I was an unemployed actor. I had spent 2 seasons playing shoulder to shoulder with actors from all over the regional theater map, from Minneapolis's Cricket Theater to repertory companies in Missouri, Indianapolis, and Milwaukee. I had never been out of California before getting the job in Cleveland. The comfort of the West Coast was calling me back to find what work I could in San Francisco or Berkeley, near where I grew up, or to woo the harsh mistress of showbiz, who reigns over Los Angeles, to gamble against the odds like so many had before. I could go anywhere. All my worldly possessions fit in my 1970 VW Beetle. So I asked around, where should I go? George and Michael, John, had quick work of telling me I would go to New York, just as they had. New York City is where actors and artists go to test their talent and their wherewithal. In New York City, I would be a part of the grand community of players, learning as much from the pulse of the city as from any performance I'd ever given. With the luck of serendipity, I'd audition for off-off-Broadway and off-Broadway and Broadway, and movies and TV and commercials and industrials, for cruise ships, for dinner theaters, for every professional theater in America. I would sell my car to bankroll the move to the city that never sleeps. Okay, that's what I did. Michael John and I drove east on I-80 together, from the Cuyahoga to the Hudson, delivering a transported car to the docks of Port Elizabeth, New Jersey. Oh my goodness, a transported car. I slept on his couch for too many weeks in the apartment he shared with a playwright and actor who didn't know me from Adam, but made me laugh all day. Michael John typed up my resume on his battleship of a Royal typewriter, which he has since given me. When I finally found a horridly dark and busted up fourth floor walk-up in Hell's Kitchen, he co-signed the lease for me. A moment of risky generosity I will never, ever forget. The New York City winter was new to me, so cold that a walk outside made my jaw hurt. I did not have winter clothes. George gave me a jacket. He also came by with milk to go with the Entenmann's blackout cakes that Michael John would bring by. George gave me his old portable black and white TV with coat hanger antenna, a pair of chairs with broken cane seats, and a kitchen-sized table that was nuts to have in a fourth-floor walk-up. Michael John showed me the ropes of the Actors' Equity Lounge, with its casting board and credit union. In the depths of February, the three of us met at George's ground-floor studio apartment just off Central Park West, the walls covered with the 8x10s of so many of his actor friends, and we did our taxes as a snowstorm howled outside. I had never done my taxes before. When these two pros showed me how to file my return so I'd get a refund from the IRS for nearly $600, the first moment of solvency in my adult life, I thought I had won the lottery. And I had. They were and are my friends. You would not be reading these words otherwise. So, what does a true bond look like? We asked three pairs of pals to tell their stories. The first one, entitled A Leap of Faith. They were casual buddies until one defining moment turned them into friends. At a conference luncheon, Dalpus and her wife asked to sit with Eanes and her whole family, including two kids, husband, mom, sister, even an aunt. Dalpus had some trepidation over whether the group would welcome the lesbian pair, but Baronexia and her family were incredibly embracing, she remembers. From there, the two college executives became closer, connecting daily, sometimes hourly, over life's challenges. Their grounding value is honesty, Eanes said. That's my definition of friendship, someone you can have honest communication with about everything. Paulette doesn't mind telling me the truth, even if I don't want to hear it. And to me, that's priceless. All right, Brian Sorg. Sarah Stegner-Lambier, 55, Wilmette, Illinois, and Tracy Vowell, 53, Kankakee, Illinois. Talking through things. Although they first met in Chicago as young chefs, their friendship really took off after Vowell moved downstate to start a farm, a difficult and isolating enterprise. Sarah understood how exhausted I was, Vowell says. By then, she was running her own restaurant and was exhausted. The two started getting together for weekly hikes, exploring nearby trails and talking about everything under the sun. I always end up feeling refreshed, peaceful, and ready to get back to work, Vowell adds. The value of knowing someone is always ready to share, listen, help, celebrate, encourage, support, discuss, gently persuade, actually be present is not immeasurable. Is not measurable. And finally, Billy Delfs, Greg Smith, 59, Waynesville, Ohio, and Kuyar Mostashvi, 46, Springboro, Ohio, across the divide. After the election of 2016, Mostashvi, a Democrat, sought to understand why so many people had voted for President Trump. Through a local group called Better Angels, he met Smith, a Republican. When Greg learned that I'm originally from Iran, he asked me about ISIS. Mostashvi recalls, I said, well, we have our lunatics, and we also have our good people, just like you. Smith suggested a lunch, which led to an ongoing bond. We talk about everything, Mostashvi points out. I'm less self-righteous now. Smith, an evangelical Christian, says the friendship has changed him too. Once anti-Muslim, he now believes that each person of faith has their own relationship with God. We're all trying to be better people, he notes. Our next article will take us into the world of medicine. Breakthrough treatments for Parkinson's, diabetes, depression, and more. Again from AARP. Innovative methods range from lightbox therapy to a mood-adjusting spray. As research, science, and technology continue to advance, doctors and other health professionals are finding new ways to treat chronic or life-threatening conditions. Here are some innovative procedures and treatments that are helping those with diabetes, heart disease, depression, and Parkinson's disease. A less invasive treatment for tremors. Deep brain stimulation surgery is the gold standard for treating Parkinson's disease tremors that don't respond to medication. It's effective in about 90% of cases, but involves implanting electrodes in the brain through surgery, which doctors don't recommend for high-risk patients. Last December, the FDA approved a new non-invasive treatment that uses MRI to guide ultrasound waves directly to the most affected areas of the brain. The treatment, called Exablate Neuro, that's Exablate, Exablate Neuro, destroys misfiring brain cells in the targeted area without requiring the opening of the skull. So this Exablate Neuro destroys misfiring brain cells in the targeted area. Using bright light as medicine for depression. Mental health professionals have used lightbox therapy for decades to treat seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, which leads to a low mood in winter, but eases its depressing grip when the days get longer. New research indicates that the same therapy may be effective for other types of depression, including treatment-resistant depression and even bipolar depression. Indeed, one recent study found that among patients hospitalized for depression, those in rooms facing southeast, which received the most light, were discharged an average of 30 days earlier than those in rooms facing northwest. Researchers believe that the therapy, which involves sitting near a light box during morning hours, resets a disordered circadian rhythm, resulting in an improved mood. All right. So, sitting near a light box during the morning hours and maybe sitting somewhere where the sun is rising and hits you, like facing southeast. All right, mood-adjusting spray for depression. Many people who have spent their lives dealing with depression have gotten used to having treatments that previously worked suddenly fail. It happened repeatedly to Robin Prothrow, 60. They work for a couple of weeks or months, and then it just goes back to the usual, she says. 2 years ago, Prothrow entered a clinical trial for esketamine, now sold as Spravato, a nasal spray related to an old approved anesthetic. She reports that her symptoms improved immediately. In March, the FDA approved the drug in conjunction with an oral antidepressant for people with treatment-resistant depression. Prothrow, meanwhile, is still going for regular treatments under her doctor's supervision. It has not stopped working for a day, she adds. All right, pretty interesting. So she entered a clinical trial for esketamine, now sold as Spravato, S-P-R-A-V-A-T-O, a nasal spray related to an old approved anesthetic. Okay, oxygen treatment that limits heart damage. During a heart attack, part of the heart muscle can die if it is deprived of oxygen. Supersaturated oxygen, SSO2 therapy, which recently won FDA approval, infuses concentrated oxygen into the area of the heart muscle that's starved of it. As a result, the size of the damaged area is reduced. The therapy is being used in experimental treatments at several U.S. hospitals. Very cool. Supersaturated oxygen, SSO2 therapy. Measuring your circadian rhythm with a blood test. It's not just the genes you have, but how they express themselves that together determine your health risks. In fact, during any 24-hour period, about half your genes are activated, with each leaving its mark in your bloodstream. Now, researchers based at Northwestern University have found a way to measure your personal internal rhythms through a blood test. It looks for your body's time signature, potentially allowing doctors to understand the absolute best times for you to eat, exercise, and work, or to receive medication or other therapy when your body will be most receptive. That is very cool. So measuring your circadian rhythm with a blood test. All right, an operation that improves diabetes control. Diabetics in Holland recently participated in a study that included not only diet and lifestyle recommendations, but also something new, an outpatient procedure known as duodenal mucosal resurfacing, or DMR, so duodenal mucosal resurfacing, that uses heat to destroy the topmost layer of about 4 inches of the duodenum, the first part of the small intestine. The idea is that the top layer will then regenerate itself, replacing cells whose disordered hormonal signaling prevents insulin from functioning optimally. I'm going to read that again. The idea is that the top layer of the duodenum or duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine, will regenerate itself, replacing cells whose disordered hormonal signaling prevents insulin from functioning optimally. 6 months after the procedure, 85% of the patients in the study had better blood sugar control and were no longer using insulin. Being able to do a procedure under sedation with no discomfort that will result in marked improvement in diabetes control is pretty extraordinary, says Gregory Ginsburg, a gastroenterologist at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, who is working on the first U.S.-based study of the procedure. The pilot study, which began in 2019, is ongoing. Okay. Now, one last quick article. Family caregivers deserve our help. They need support as they deal with physical, emotional, and financial stress. Family caregiving is a beautiful expression of love and togetherness. At the same time, caregivers can often feel very much alone, overwhelmed, and underprepared for the tasks they need to perform. As caregivers deal with physical, emotional, and financial stress, they deserve and need respect and support. For the last 7 years of my husband's life as he battled Parkinson's, I was his primary caregiver. When I traveled for my job, our friends or relatives would come stay and keep him company, make dinner, and ensure he received his medications. I was fortunate that I could pay for outside care when I needed it. Many families cannot. Today, there are more than 40 million versions of this story in the United States, people carrying out a true labor of love, but sometimes bent under the weight of caregiving. That is why I was so pleased that Congress last year created the Family Caregiving Advisory Council. The council will make recommendations to the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services on effective models of family caregiving and support to family caregivers. And now I am honored to have been named to that council. I will call upon my years of experience as a nurse instructor, and a caregiver as I assume that role, one that is especially important at a time when half of family caregivers are carrying out medical or nursing tasks for individuals with challenges in physical, cognitive, and behavioral health. In this new world of caregiving, hospitals and healthcare professionals need to provide instruction to caregivers, and employers should help employees balance the demands of caregiving. I am proud that AARP offers employees 80 hours a year of paid caregiving leave. Governments have a key role as well. AARP supports a tax credit of up to $3,000 for family caregiving. It is presumed that every home is a potential hospital, and every service that that person needs can be provided by an unpaid family member, with only occasional visits by a primary care provider, nurse, or therapist. According to a recent report from AARP that stated that millions of family members, friends, and neighbors provide complex care at home. Please write to me with your caregiving experiences, tips, and suggestions. I promise that we at AARP will read every letter to help shape our thinking and to inform my work as a member of the Family Caregiving Advisory Council. And this is by, write to Catherine Alicia George and Georges at AARP 601 East Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., 20049. All right. Well, I'm afraid that brings us to the end of our program, and we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anika Gall, reading for the NC Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. I hope you have a great week, and I look forward to seeing you next week. Take care.